You're listening to the Mythgrim Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Mike Hernandez, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there. Tell her what to do, so she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
Today's episode is brought to you by our sponsor, Kathy Ferguson, a professor of political theory in Star Trek.
This is the Mythgrim Podcast. I'm Mike, and with me today are
Chris
and
Oren.
And today we have decided to combine our forces in order to take over the world, or at least the podcasting world, as it may be.
I think specifically we want to threaten these people that seem to be like the chosen one or something. We don't really have a reason. We just want to make their life bad.
Yeah, I think maybe we'll like pursue them like across space for a while and like be kind of like vaguely menacing without having a clear goal, I think is our plan,
yeah.
Right?
Because somebody posted on the internet that they like might someday overthrow us, and it was just some internet commenter, but you know, we're just being careful, just in case.
Yeah, you got like, I mean, especially, or like,
you have to aim high. That's why, you know, total domination of the podcast world, just so we control it all, and then we can keep those pesky commenters in line.
All right, so today we're talking about antagonistic organizations and making ones that work and are cool and are not like a few others that I could mention. You know, we were just talking about, for example, the Dark Fae from Lost Girl, who have really no reason to be harassing the main character, but they do.
Cause... Also the Light Fae?
Yeah, sort of, the Light Fae.
Sort of. Well, they say they do in the first episode. Whether they actually do is another question.
They don't.
But like, maybe we're the good guys, but we can't be on the side of the hero, so we're not really the good guys.
No, let me tell you. What basically happens after the first episode is that Bo becomes Light Fae, but she refuses to pay her membership fees. Is basically what's happening. Is she has all the benefits of being Light Fae because she hangs out with the Light Fae, and the Light Fae's like bruisers help her in fights and stuff, but she doesn't have to like obey any of the rules because she refused to join. And at one point she does finally get called on that, like 3 seasons in, and someone's like, you are basically just a Light Fae who like didn't formally sign up. And I was like, that's fair. I'm glad someone finally pointed that out.
So she just exploits the fact that they're living in the Masquerade and therefore can't legally enforce union dues.
Yeah, exactly.
Because doing so, they'd have to reveal themselves to the U.S. government. And since they can't do that, she can just get away with reaping the benefit.
Precisely.
She prefers to, like, bully or beg help out of them instead of just get it.
She's a right-to-work fae.
She's a free rider is what she is. So part of the reason why the Dark Fae don't work as an evil organization is, again, they're kind of like evil for the sake of it, at least in the first few seasons. The show can't decide if they're like a political organization or the big bad, right? Are they Wolfram and Hart and like they have a plan to end the world, or are they just like a political party with some particularly distasteful members? Like, we don't, the show kind of waffles back and forth on that. Every Dark Fae we see acts like a huge jerk. The Dark Fae are never actually behind any of the evil plots that Bo is, like, investigating. Once in a while, but very, very rarely. They almost always go out of their way to show that it's some renegade, not, like, anyone actually connected to the Dark Fae. So it's, like, if at some point you start to wonder, why are the Dark Fae even here? Why are we spending time, like, knowing about these people who are huge jerks, but never actually do anything interesting?
That is a good question. That seems like ripe for having some villains there. That's a little strange for a show to give up on a villain opportunity.
Yeah, well,
maybe they're saving them for later.
We do have the Morrigan, who is the leader of the Dark Fae, like in the city. But again, she's very evil, but not an evil in any kind of proactive way, right? She's like, we see her and she's very like, I'll get you someday, Bo, and she like swirls a wine glass at something. But like, she doesn't really participate very actively in trying to kill Bo. Again, for reasons we don't understand why she would even want to do that.
Because she's a freeloader.
That's true, but on the other guys, right? So that might potentially be a benefit to the Dark Fae.
It's the principle of the matter. Look, both sides are very committed to the idea that you must choose a side. If she can just go along and get all the benefits without actually committing, then maybe her minions will stop committing and try to reap the Dark Fae benefits anyway.
Yeah, that's true. That'd be bad precedent to set.
I have to say, I sometimes feel like the Cylons in the newer Battlestar Galactica act the same way. Like, the humans are just so, like, pathetic. But they put a lot of time and energy into effort into, like, taunting them and tormenting them, like, all the time. You got the colonies. You took them over. There's barely any humans left, and they, like, went away.
The Cylons evolve as a threat over the course of the show, and not really in a good way. In the moment when I was watching it, it seemed like the showrunners had a very in-depth plan. Like, they sold that idea, but taking the long, big picture look at it after the fact, not so much.
You may recall that at the beginning of every episode,
they did say,
the opening said, and they have a plan.
And they have a plan.
That was a lie. They did not have a plan. We learned that over the course of the series. They had no idea what they were doing.
Well, the Cylons had a plan. The showrunners didn't.
The Cylons actually did not have a plan. We found this out later.
They had a plan. It was a very bad plan. It wasn't written until the last season. But that's how fiction works.
Right.
So I will give the Cylons a little bit of credit, okay? So let's consider this from the Cylons' perspective. They have just wiped out, like, 99.99 repeating percent of their opponent's population, right? Which is a really brutal, cold-hearted thing to do, but that was their strategy. They were like, we are going to wipe them out. We will not leave anyone left to try to take vengeance on us, right? And then one ship, which is a very powerful ship, and we've seen that, like, part of the reason the Cylons needed to do that sneak attack where they killed everything at once was that Cylon ships are pretty lame. Like Galactica, which is like the oldest Battlestar around, can take them two at a time. And like Pegasus can take on like four or five of their base stars and come out on top. So the Battlestars are very powerful, and there's one of them still out there. And it wouldn't surprise me if Cylon's point of view was that they're imagining that the humans are thinking, well, we're doomed as a species, but maybe we can make the Cylons pay first. Like, if a real nation had just done that to an opposing country, and one of those opposing countries' battleships had escaped, and was just sailing around, yeah, I could see that they would try to destroy it, because who knows what it might do, right?
Well, it's even worse than that, because Galactica got away with nukes.
That's true.
So they could potentially use nukes against them in the future if they don't take out that threat. Also, the Cylons disappeared for, what, 30 years, and then came back with unimaginable force to wipe out the humans. It's reasonable to be paranoid that if you leave any survivors, they're going to use the exact same tactic.
Yeah, that part's not unreasonable. It does start to get kind of weird when, like, we see to what extent the Cylons have infiltrated the fleet.
Yes.
And it does get to the point where they probably should have figured out that the humans were not interested in fighting them anymore, that the humans were just trying to leave.
Or actually killed them off instead of doing all sorts of other weird things.
Right, yeah. This is the part where it gets kind of weird, right? Because the Cylons, the two Cylons, Caprica 6 and Boomer, take over, right? Like, they have a power play, and they become the leaders of the Cylons, and they decide that they're not going to try to wipe out the humans anymore. They're going to try to live in peace with them. Their idea of living in peace with the humans is finding the human planet and occupying it. How did they think that was going to go? I mean, I'm really wondering what their version of this endgame was, because it didn't seem like they had one. It was just like, they showed up and were like, hey guys, we're occupying you. Nothing bad will come of this.
Yeah, it's like they haven't, you know, studied human history at all.
Yeah. As the show progresses, they get more spiritual, the Cylons, that is, mm-hmm. in their motivations, and it gets harder to understand why they're doing what they're doing. Heck, even some of the Cylons are like, what does this matter? Why are you guys so worried about this awe and stuff and trying to be human? The old guy Cylon even says, I am glad I'm not a human. When I look at this supernova, I see in more than just the visible spectrum, because I am a Cylon. I am superior. Why are you guys so obsessed with following them?
Oh, I loved one. He was my favorite Cylon, because he was just as frustrated with the plot as I was.
Exactly. He was also just as frustrated with the Cylons as an antagonistic organization,
yes.
as we were.
Another sort of more classic antagonistic organization that never made any sense was the government conspiracy in X-Files.
I don't even know if you can call that an organization, because if we take every episode of X-Files as being correct, this is an organization that is running, assuming they're all the same organization is behind them, it's running like 500 projects at once, like in completely separate like areas and often opposing each other. For, like, no discernible purpose, right? But to the point where it's really hard to imagine this is... It really feels more like, in the X-Files universe, like every government official and military officer with any kind of authority is running his own alien experiment. Just, like, independently of all the others.
That kind of sounds like Cerberus from Mass Effect, actually.
It does a bit.
With, like, hundreds of experiments going on secretly and branches of the organization opposed to each other.
I feel like it was similar a little bit to Lost. past, and that what it felt like the writers were doing is they were only thinking about what would be, like, cool and, like, mysterious and threatening episode per episode, mm-hmm. and not actually looking at what the bigger picture was at all.
Well, I'm pretty sure that's exactly what they were doing, right? I mean,
yeah.
Unlike Lost, the X-Files writers never lied to us and said that they had a plan, right? I mean, Lost was particularly egregious for that because they promised us from day one that this was all planned out and they knew exactly what was happening, and they didn't. But X-Files never made that promise.
X-Files definitely, in the writing, though, hinted that there was some bigger yes. picture. Mm-hmm. Like, in the shows, because they had this, like, character that would, like, give them hints, you know, this stuff. Mm-hmm. They definitely hinted that there was something bigger going on. The story gave watchers an expectation yes. that they would figure it out.
I was referring to outside the show, because, yeah. like, the Lost writers said in interviews that this was all planned and that they knew where this was going to end. They overtly lied to us, whereas yeah. the X-Files writers only implicitly lied to right. us.
The X-Files was also written when the expectations were different. Serialized plots were much less common then, so they could get away with being episodic and not worrying about how all of the different episodes tied together, because the audiences weren't yet trained to have that as, like, the default expectation
right.
for a long-running show.
Well, also, I mean, as long as you keep a lot of things mysterious, like, you can kind of get away with that for a while. You can get away with that until the point in the climax of the series where audiences actually expect to know what's going on, right? In order to actually pull off the climax, but again, you can get, if you do that, you can get away with it for a surprising long time, and it will keep people hooked because there's so many bizarre things. They're like, I must know how they fit together.
That was the reason I stopped watching Lost after a while, was in season 3, it became clear to me that even if they spent every episode after season 3 explaining all the stuff that didn't make sense, they wouldn't have enough episodes left. Mm-hmm. Like, they just didn't have time. and because every new episode, they introduced like 2 or 3 things that didn't make sense, and promised they would explain them later. And I don't think this has anything to do with evil organizations. I think we've been sidetracked by Lost. That's what Lost does yep. to us.
Here's my question for you. When it comes to this sort of bizarre episode per episode, not actually planning anything, leaving things mysterious, like, have you ever seen any, like, single antagonists do the same thing?
What do you mean?
Well, okay, so in both the cases of Lost and X-Files, etc., what we have is, like, a larger organization that is supposedly doing bizarre things, and in the end we find out it makes no sense. I suppose that wouldn't be strictly limited to antagonist organizations, but it's, can't remember a villain where there was a similar effect, where the villain would just do really random bizarre things in sort of a mysterious manner, and then at the end found that the writers had not actually known what the hell the villain was doing or what their motivation was.
I mean, you could make an argument that the two lawyers who represent Wolfram and Hart are doing that. I mean, granted, they are doing it on the behest of Wolfram and Hart, but they have, like, names and faces that I cannot remember right now. But, you know, there was the dude and the lady, and the dude eventually, like, got tattoos and could play the guitar because that actor can play the guitar and he plays it, like, in everything right. that he's in. I like that actor, but and I don't remember the lady's name either.
Yeah, well, as you're saying, they're doing it as actors of the organization. The only things that I can think of are, like, really poorly written cartoons. There are plenty of plots in G.I. Joe where someone, a villain, comes in and hatches a new plan, and I suppose he's using the organization to implement the plan, but this villain came up with this completely ridiculous plan. One of them involves, if I'm remembering this correctly, sinking a Russian submarine with some sort of chemical, waiting a year, and then using the submarine, which has now the Russian sailors have turned into zombies, to attempt to take over the world via the channel between England and France.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's a solid plan. No, I mean, that's basically Transformers, right? Like, every new episode, Megatron is trying to do something else, and it's like, especially, well, the old one anyway. So, some of the newer ones actually have, like, a plot. It's weird.
Whoa.
But, like, the original Transformers, like, every episode, Megatron's up to something shifty, and it's not really clear how these often, like, assist his theoretical end goal of destroying the Autobots. I mean, but you're right. It's usually a thing that happens with organizations, right?
Yeah, right. Is it in specifically antagonists because they're supposed to be, like, in the beginning, they're supposed to be very threatening, and so you don't know anything about them because they're mm-hmm. supposed to be threatening, and that makes them threatening. And then sometimes when you get to know them, that doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, well, especially because, so this is one of the things you need to ask yourself about your antagonistic organization right off the bat, and when you're making one, is why doesn't it just crush the hero like a bug? Because, like, antagonistic organizations need to be threatening, right? Like, mm-hmm. we get that. And very often the hero is, like, either one person or a handful of small people who don't have a lot of resources, which is all fine, but a lot of stories forget to answer the question of why the bad guys don't just crush them. like immediately. And that is why so many of these big organizations fall apart, like it happened with Wolfram and Hart. Because Wolfram and Hart, we've seen that sometimes they actually have pretty powerful forces at their disposal, and they could theoretically just, they've had like multiple chances to just kill Angel, and they don't. And the reason that they don't, the reason that's finally given is that they apparently need him for some kind of prophecy to end the world, I think. But it, that motivation becomes increasingly hard to take seriously the more damage he causes them, right?
That's not revealed until a couple seasons in, right?
It might even, I don't remember exactly when they revealed it.
Like, it almost feels post hoc justifying why in previous seasons they haven't dealt with this pest to them before.
Yeah.
And in the end, they end up looking, like, really incompetent. Which is like, why is this organization still running? Like, they can't, right, like, get anything done.
The Gua'uld had the same problem in Stargate, where the Gua'uld theoretically
Gua'uld.
Gua'uld. The ghouls. The ghouls, them, damn it.
Gua'uld.
Yeah, whatever.
Orin.
Those guys.
Kree.
So they had the same problem where, theoretically, they probably could have just crushed Earth anytime they wanted to. And the explanation that they always gave was that, well, Earth's not big enough of a fish to fry. But, like, that stopped being the case pretty quickly. Like, Earth was doing some serious harm to the Gua'uld operations. And, like, you would, it's hard to imagine that at no point did the System Lords, like, just figure maybe we could pause our conflict for a minute and destroy Earth, which is, like, straight up killed Apophis at one point. Like, Apophis tried to destroy Earth and he failed. And you would think at that point the Gua'uld would be like, well, we should probably take those guys out.
Actually, at one point they did, and a few seasons in, that's exactly what happened. They're like, oh, yeah, these guys are actually a threat. We should take notice of them. And the resolution to that was basically putting Earth under the Asgard protection.
Yeah, they did eventually get around to that. I'll give them credit for that much.
See, the thing that is so disappointing to me about Wolfram and Hart is that they had methods at their disposal other than just straight out violence that mm-hmm. they could have really used. It would have been much more interesting if they had actually been like lawful evil like they should be, because they're lawyers,
yeah,
and actually used the law against him, because he's a typical renegade hero that goes around like causing damage as he saves people. One of the first few episodes, he like throws a guy out of a window of a skyscraper.
The very first yes. episode, a very important person in LA.
Like, I don't even, did they do anything? Why didn't he like get a trial? Or
I mean, they do have one episode where they send a lawyer to his like building and basically serve him an eviction notice, and that was like one of the scariest episodes. Because, yeah. like, Angel had no way to fight that.
Right. And I wish they'd done a lot more of that. Like,
I believe with the shoving the guy out the window, the reason they could not do anything to Angel about it was the person he shoved out the window was a vampire, and therefore he turned to dust on his way down.
And so they have a body.
So there's no body, therefore no murder.
At the same time, they, I think, didn't they have it on video?
I don't think they strictly said that they did. It's possible that they might have. I mean, I'm willing to forgive them that one. Although, again, when that first happened, I was expecting the next episode was going to be like, all right, Angel has just, like, declared war on Wolfram and Hart. It's going to be right. on now. And then we didn't hear from them again for, like,
half a season.
Yeah, and it was like, what? Hang on. You just, how are you the big bads and, like, in the city, and you let someone do that to you and you don't even retaliate?
Look, right. Angel's busy being broody and doing his noir stuff. We can't be bothered with the big bad.
I just think the show could have been a lot more interesting if, as they were tackling episode to episode villains, in the background there's this organization that is constantly putting out warrants for their arrest and evicting mm-hmm. them from all the buildings they're in and doing lots of legal things that maybe don't completely like kill them, but really make it harder for them to do their work. You know, right. like that's what it could have been, and it's just really disappointing that they didn't go there.
Yeah. They honestly weren't that interesting to me as an organization until season 5, when they have gotten Angel and his gang to work and run the local branch of Wolfram and Hart. And at that point, it's like, okay, now they are actually using bureaucracy to tie their hands. And that's, these very good characters are trying to run an evil organization in a way where they will prevent bad from happening. When, yeah, it that created more interesting conflicts than, like, the previous 4 seasons combined.
It was interesting, but it was also hard to imagine how that was, like, supposed to work. Like, the actual motivation behind it. And people kept being so afraid that all the heroes are going to be tempted into evil. And I just wasn't feeling it. I don't know.
They were all also like mind altered and brainwashed for half the season too. That ended up being a factor later on. Again, I'm not sure how much of that is like post hoc the writers. Oh, we have been kind of writing these characters weird for a while. Maybe we should erase that.
Part of the problem with Wolfram and Hart, I think, was that one of the questions that, again, you should ask when you are constructing your organization is, what are the means at its disposal? How does it get done the things it wants to get done? And with Wolfram and Hart, the obvious example, because they're a company of lawyers, they're a law firm, the obvious method that they use would be legal action, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we almost never saw them do that. As Chris was pointing out, when they actually ever did get off their butts and oppose Angel, it was almost always by, like, hiring goons or, like, you know, using some kind of magic talisman thingy or something like that. And Wolfram and Hart suffered from the problem that a lot of long-running antagonistic organizations suffer from, which was that Angel has beat them too many times. Do you remember the episode where he, like, locks up half of their senior executive staff in a room with two vampires and they all get murdered? And I was just really surprised they didn't have any kind of security measures in place. Like, this is a company that supposedly, like, deals with the supernatural on, like, a regular basis, and they had no protection or anything. They were just helpless.
Yeah, and it went the other way, too, actually, because Angel would keep threatening to kill them and keep not doing it. In fact, they even lampshaded it in one episode where the female lawyer, I can't remember her name.
Yeah, I don't remember her
name. It's okay,
either.
We don't remember either of the lawyer's names. So.
Single female lawyer,
well, Lindsay,
I think
the guy's
name
was Lindsay, actually. I remember.
Oh, right, yeah, because his name was Lindsay. I remember that his name is Lindsay, because it's kind of an unusual name for a guy. That's why I remember it.
But anyway, so she's, like, in her car in the parking lot, and he threatens to, like, kill her for the umpteenth time.
Yeah.
Yep.
She's just like, your useless threats.
Your
empty threats are so empty, or your empty threats are empty, or something like that, is all she responds to him, and then just leaves.
Yep.
And it's like, yep, that's exactly what's been happening on
empty
both sides.
After empty threat. After empty threat.
And it's just, yeah, the whole thing.
It actually kind of reminds me of a role-playing game where the GM won't let the players go after the bad guys because, like, he's not done with them yet. Like, he wants them to stick around for a few more sessions. And the players are just getting frustrated. And they're like, we could just go kill them. We could do that. And the GM's like, no, you wouldn't want, you can't do that. And so they just, like, yell impotently because there's nothing else they can do. It's kind of what that feels like.
Look, the pizza for this session is brought to you by the villains. Do you want to have pizza next session?
I think one of the faults that comes with a lot of antagonists is just escalating the situation too quickly. I think a lot of storytellers make that mistake, and it's like you're planning at the big bad that's supposed to last for, like, the series or the season or, you know, the novel, whatever it is, and just too soon getting right into the thick of things instead of taking your time to, like, start with some minions that are intimidating, you know? And then once the hero becomes capable of fighting off the minions, then you can go up a level, you know, instead of, like, right away engaging, killing important lawyers at Wolfram and Hart, because then it's just not sustainable. You can't keep going and make it realistic.
And, like, what was weird was that, like, one of the lawyers that they killed was the two main lawyers' boss. Angel basically went over their heads and beat up the people who were in charge of them, but they stuck around as enemies. And it was, you know, an evil organization that we were talking about really, really well is the Fire Nation from Avatar: The Last Airbender. And these guys, I cannot say enough good things about the Fire Nation, okay? Because they have everything down. They have a method, and their method is overwhelming force and fire. That's how they solve their problems. That's what they do, and that is very effective for the things they want to do. They have that going on. They have a couple of personalities within the organization that kind of represent them. So they have Admiral Zhao, they have Azula, they eventually have Fire Lord Ozai, and we have a couple of other recurring fire officers. And they have a reason not to just smash the protagonist, because the protagonists are very mobile, and the Fire Nation is a giant army. And so they don't have any flying machines, so it's really hard for them to chase down Aang and his friends. And they try, and sometimes they get close, but because Aang has a flying bison, he's usually able to stay one step ahead of them, but he can't ever beat them.
Yeah.
So it's a perfect situation, and they do what you say, where it starts off with Aang fighting Zuko, and the first couple of times Aang fights Zuko, it's a really close thing, and then at the exact right moment when Zuko stops being threatening as a villain, he transitions into a possible protagonist because he's no longer a threat to the group, right? And so he stops being a villain, and then we go into Zuko's arc, which is also brilliant. And at the same time, the same thing happens with Zhao, and then they upgrade to Azula, and Azula stays scary for like a good two seasons. And then they finally upgrade from Azula to Ozai, who they've been talking up for like the entire show. And so that is the perfect, like, pyramid of evil going up all the way to the big bad Mark Hamill himself.
Yeah. One show whose antagonist organizations I really like is The 100, which obviously I like this show a lot.
Yeah, you have not quite watched it 100 times yet.
But one thing I like about The 100 is it is all gray versus gray. It's not black and white morality. But on the surface, it sometimes appears in season one, introduce these cannibals that, like, look pure evil. But then in season two, you find out more about them, and it takes that away. And so it has this group of antagonists that are referred to as the Mountain Men. Mm-hmm. And they're just, in season one, you just hear about them threatening. You don't really, you maybe see them at the very, like, outlast episode, but they're kind of in the background, and the people who are natives are very scared of them, but they're just kind of that in that mysterious and threatening stage. But then as soon as they start season two, and they reveal, like, who they actually are, they are humanized. So once we switch away from them being, and they're still antagonists throughout the season two, but, you know, as soon as they are not mysterious anymore, they have that sort of human aspect, and again, it becomes a closer to a gray versus gray kind of struggle.
Yeah, I don't recall there really being what I would call bad guys in 100, because, like, everyone is various levels of jerk. And
right.
It's sort of a and it's sort of a question of, like, it's really more of a political struggle than a good versus evil.
Right. Well, when you meet the cannibals, it really looks that way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, again, it's just them, like, pretending that there's evil people so that they can take it away.
It's a bait and switch is what it is.
Yeah. Which I enjoy.
The bait is human flesh.
What about you, Mike? Do you have a favorite or least favorite antagonist organization?
Probably one of my favorites, as you guys might guess, is the Empire in Star Wars.
Well, you gotta love the classics.
Yes. So the Empire is the epitome of bureaucratic war machine. Super efficient at times, but also, like, plotting, and it's perfect for whatever the scenario that is needed for the story, because they have powerful war machines and overwhelming force, but they can also have the incompetent individual officers or stormtroopers. So, like, incredibly intimidating in, say, Empire Strikes Back, and can be played a little more for comedy in, say, Star Wars Rebels, which is aimed for younger audiences.
That's true, although I do have to admit, Rebels, the amount of times the main characters escape from the Empire in Rebels is starting to try my patience. Like, I'm like, okay, I get that escaping is dramatic, but they seriously escape, like, two or three times in one episode. It's, like, getting a little ridiculous.
It has a little bit much of that. Have you gotten to season two yet?
No, I'll get there eventually.
Yeah, so season two, they introduce Vader, and things become more integrated with the larger rebellion, and so it kind of transitions from caper of the week, which means they're always escaping in that show format, to a show that's more similar in composition to the Clone Wars cartoon in the later seasons.
And the Empire also, like, another thing that makes your organization important, that makes it, like, viable in the story, is that it needs to be distinctive in some way. That's another failing of Wolfram and Hart, is that Wolfram and Hart doesn't have a look or anything that really sets them apart. I guess you could argue their look is people in suits.
They have, like, two people that we know, and then everyone else could be cast as anyone.
Yeah, they could just, so it's, they're not very distinctive as villains. They don't have a style, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Empire has a clear visual aesthetic and a way of doing things. And same thing with the Fire Nation. Like, they both have very clear, like, this is who we are, this is what you do, you know who the Empire is. Pretty quickly. The opening shot of the first Star Wars movie has been talked about a lot, but it's, you know, you see that long Star Destroyer that just keeps going, and then you see the stormtroopers just, like, overwhelming the rebel defenders by weight of numbers, and it's like, yeah, this is the Empire, this is how they do things. And that is I think that is not to be underestimated in why we like the Empire so much. And their technology is also, like, very distinctive looking when compared to what the Rebels are using. Like, it looks very different.
Yeah, they have a very strong identity. One organization that I think is, again, when it comes to organizations being too incompetent, I've got to say, I mean, there's probably a lot of problems with, like, the Institute and Buffy season 4.
Hmm.
But one thing that drives me nuts is that, so they're basically military guys. And then they just invite her in, and then they get annoyed when she starts asked questions instead of just takes orders. It's like, look, if you're in the military, you've been through a series of training that's designed to make you just accept orders. Intensive training to get to that point. Like, just inviting a random civilian in and expecting her not to, like, poke around or ask questions is just really silly.
Yeah.
Feels like they should know much better than that.
I was surprised when they let her in at all. Like, mm-hmm. I was like, really? They're not concerned that this rogue element is going to compromise their operational security? Like, that just seems unlikely.
They are a very strange organization. It's government black ops, military-style organization that seems to exclusively recruit college grad students.
They are,
and their cover,
some...
their cover is they are TAs and they live in a fraternity together. Like, that is a really, that's a very small pool to recruit from.
It begs the question, like, why couldn't they just leave them underground? Why would they even need, like, an above-ground cover?
Well, and I also think part of the problem with the Institute was, again, it was sort of a theming issue, where part of Buffy, like, part of the thing that everyone who watches Buffy, like, implicitly agrees to is not to question how the masquerade is intact. Because the show is not interested in telling us. Like, there is no explanation for that. And we have all, like, as Buffy fans, we have all made, like, signed a deal with Whedon that we will just pretend that the masquerade is a thing. And then in season 4, Whedon's like, oh, by the way, the government knows about vampires. What? Whedon, we went with you for 3 seasons and didn't ask questions. And now you're here telling us that you're pretending you're clever for having the government know about vampires? No. Come on, Joss, you can do better than that.
I still think it's better than an angel, where there's, like, monsters running through Los Angeles, and people still aren't supposed to, it's Los Angeles! Like, yep. at least we can pretend in Sunnydale that, like, this town is just really weird and isolated or something. But, like, in Los Angeles?
Doesn't start out as a full-fledged masquerade, because, like, some of the vampires try to blend in at, like, the nightclub scene so that they can prey upon people, but the vampires and demons aren't living amongst people and mm-hmm. acting out their normal lives in a full masquerade fashion. So it's like the only people really trying to maintain the masquerade are Buffy and the Scoobies, because they don't want to be labeled as weirdos or, you know, psychotic.
Although Buffy could really, like, benefit from, you know, maybe getting a paycheck for all the work she's doing.
Yes. An organization that's antagonistic, though not evil, from the same show is the Watchers Council.
Oh, those guys.
Who are just a bunch of dicks, really.
Yeah, we have, again, they're just a bunch of jerks. We don't really know what their motivation is, really. Like, theoretically, they're there to kill vampires, but they don't seem to do very much of that. And
like a bunch of backseat drivers. Like, you would have, like, an entire council of backseat drivers just for one slayer. It's yes. Like, really?
And why don't you give Buffy a paycheck?
Yeah, just like, hey, it's like, you know, just roll in and be like, hey, Buffy, you're covered for life now because you're going to be full-time vampire hunting. We're giving you plenty of money. We're going to take care of your parents and your sister wasn't around yet. But we're going to take care of everybody who you care about. And it'll be great. It's easy sailing from here. Yeah. And then in the next season, when she finds out they're kind of jerks, it's like a real reason. It's a real conflict to break away from
them. Right. Yeah. And obviously the Watchers are paying themselves because there's no way you're living, you know, with all of those expensive artifacts and the huge collection of first editions on a high school librarian's salary.
We also know that they can pay, like, pull strings because they arranged for her mom to get a job in Sunnydale and for, you know, Giles to get a job in Sunnydale.
Right.
So it's like they clearly are capable of pulling strings and getting lots of people jobs. Like, why they couldn't just pay Buffy?
They can also apparently hire, like, mercenaries with tasers, which in the Joss Whedon universe is, like, the most powerful thing you can have. So, like, I don't know why they only... Apparently they use those exclusively to hunt down rogue slayers, mm-hmm. which... Like, they don't use them to fight vampires, and then, like, I can't help but wonder why no one in the Watchers' Council has brought that up as, like, a question in the meeting. It's like, we have all these mercenaries. Are we not using them for anything?
Yeah, well, considering, like, a slayer, how often rogue slayers happen, which is probably not that often, it's surprising that they would have anybody do
right.
rogue slayers.
Right, and, like, I was frankly expecting a reveal that the Watchers' Council was actually, like, trying to cause the apocalypse. And, like, their entire... I had suspected that their entire reason for existing was to control the Slayer and make sure the Slayer didn't actually, like, do any real good, right? Because that seemed
cool.
to be what they were doing. And they have, like, a specific ritual that if the Slayer isn't, like, controllable, they'll just kill her. So,
oh, they do?
Yeah, they have that thing, remember, where Buffy has to, like, fight a vampire without her powers and stuff?
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
So they clearly, and, like, the stuff that they do would honestly make way more sense if their entire purpose was to prevent the Slayer from actually saving the world. Because they can't just end the Slayer because a new one will just pop up, right? Mm-hmm. So it makes more sense for them to camp on all the potentials, and when a Slayer pops up, to be like, hey, Slayer, we're here to train you, but, like, really badly, and then it all makes sense. Like, that would all work, but apparently...
That's kind of what the Giles from the movie does. Is
yeah, a
like,
little bit.
I'm gonna train you up. Like I did the last one, until you're nice and ripe, and the vampire villain can kill you again. Like he always does.
And I was really expecting that was going to be a reveal in season 7, but it was not. It was specifically not the case. They made it very clear that was not what was happening.
Unspoiler alert?
Unspoiler alert. My headcanon is not true.
Okay, but still, I think the award for the dumbest antagonist organization ever is still the EPA and the Ghostbusters. I mean, one question you gotta ask is, like, would doing the evil thing actually get this antagonist organization what they want?
Well, hang on.
Actually...
Hang on. Maybe you and I are remembering different movies, but if I recall, I'm gonna debate you on this. Debate Cast 2016. But as I recall, the EPA in the Ghostbusters movie is trying to shut down an unlicensed group of wackos who are running fusion reactors. And when
in a condemned building.
And when they come to do that, these guys tell them they can't because they're fighting ghosts. If I was the EPA, I would shut those guys down right now. Like, if I was the head of the EPA and someone was like, oh yeah, by the way, we've got these, like, four guys running fusion reactors in a condemned building in the middle of New York City, I'd be like, no, they can't do that. Why are they doing that? It's because it's to fight ghosts, sir. And, like, ghosts aren't real. I'm sorry. They don't get to have fusion reactors because they think ghosts are real.
Okay, but the reason why it does not seem believable to me is because environmentalists are all about their environmental impact statements. And, like, the idea that this EPA would want to shut down something that clearly has ramifications if it gets shut down...
Well, the part that it gets weird is that the EPA didn't, like, immediately move in to take custody of their unlicensed fusion reactors, right? That part is a little strange.
Right, but the idea that they would shut down...
Well, no one knew about it.
The idea that they would just come in and just randomly order a guy to shut down a system that they do not fully understand... When they're all about looking at the effects of things that enter the environment, that's not how that works.
Unless the fear is that it's not exactly what they say it is, and every moment that it's on, it is putting things into the environment. Typically, if someone has introduced something within the past month that should not be there, I think it is a reasonable course of action to shut it down as quickly as possible, especially in an urban environment.
I guess the question is what they thought it was, right? If they thought it was a nuclear reactor, then shutting it down improperly was a terrible idea because doing that can cause catastrophic problems. If they thought it was just like, I don't know, maybe they just thought the Ghostbusters were using electricity without paying for it, then maybe that would make sense to turn it off.
At the same time, the characters do make it very clear that there are, like, potentially negative effects for just plain old shutting it down.
Yeah.
And an environmentalist...
Because ghosts. Like, okay, so here's the context of the situation. These guys have an unlicensed reactor in a condemned building. They claim they are using it in order to imprison ghosts. A, ghosts aren't real, so they're wackos. B, no one has invented fusion and made it work successfully, so obviously this is not a fusion reactor. So let's shut this down and get some safety people in here to investigate what they're actually doing, rather than allowing them to continue to potentially cause harm.
I mean, maybe I'd have to watch the scene again, but how I remember the scene was, this is a storage facility. You are shutting off a storage device, and when you turn off the storage device, it's going to release a whole bunch of things
ghosts.
Into the atmosphere. Well, see, but I don't remember the scene being that way. I don't remember the scene being the main character sounding crazy, just being like, you can't shut it off because ghosts. Well, I don't believe in ghosts. I don't remember the scene being that way. I remember the scene being, this is a complicated storage mechanism, and if you turn it off, it's going to release all of these bad things.
As I recall, they did specifically say ghosts. I could be wrong. I remember that in the moment, I was very on the Ghostbusters side because, like, the Ghostbusters are super charismatic. And I was like, the mean old EPA, why they gotta come down on us in our open carry and our unlicensed fusion reactors? I get that the whole movie is, like, weird right-wing propaganda, but at the time, I was very on the Ghostbusters side. But as I recall, from the EPA's perspective, I think what they were doing kind of made sense. If for no other reason than... They probably didn't believe it was an actual fusion reactor, because again, that's impossible. Or not impossible, but that, like, no one can do it yet. I would assume they just thought these guys were running some kind of weird generator in this building.
Right.
And, like, it's not licensed for it.
And, like, with a building that's condemned, maybe every minute they left it on, it would be like, this is a fire hazard. This is put together by a crazy person. Who knows how good the wiring is, right?
Right. It's really antithetical to the way environmentalists operate to, like, approach a piece of machinery they know nothing about after they are warned there are bad effects of turning it off and just randomly turning it off without understanding what it does.
That's true. I mean, that part is a little weird. But overall, I am actually very sympathetic to the EPA in that movie. That's another one of those ones where the premise of Ghostbusters is kind of self-defeating, which is that no one has noticed ghosts except these four guys. They've noticed ghosts, but nobody else has. And it's like, and so, like, the government's trying to shut them down because no one in the government knows about ghosts either, apparently.
The beginning of the movie establishes that two of them have been spending their entire career trying to prove paranormal activities, and, like, in that library sequence is the very first time they've actually had physical evidence of ghosts.
I guess ghosts are supposed to be a new thing.
Yeah. They've been around, but these two are fired because they've completely failed at everything that they've done academically.
It's because of Zool. Because Zool approaches.
Well, yes. And then Zool approaching is why they're suddenly able to hit the jackpot with the ghost-busting business, because ghosts are coming out of all the cracks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we should ban Ghostbusters before I am tempted to go on a long rant about all the other problems with that movie.
Oh, there's so many problems.
So many problems.
It's a ridiculous movie, and it's fun and ridiculous, and yes, let's move on.
So I've noticed that of all the good, like, evil organizations on my list, all of them are big military empires. Like, every single one.
Maybe that's because people, like, understand how big military empires operate?
I guess they are basically all parallels for either the Soviet Union or the Nazis, so that makes sense. Like, that's a pretty well-trod genre. Because, like, I'm looking at the rest of my list, and I've got, like, the Dominion from Deep Space Nine, who I really liked, because they have, like, again, a really distinctive look, and, like, their soldiers are really neat, and their goals are very understandable.
I just like the way they built, like, alliances and that sort of political maneuvering. That was really cool.
Yeah, I mean, they set that up, like, seasons in advance of, like, predicting the collapse of Cardassia and then the Klingon invasion and then allowing the Dominion to come in. That was fascinating.
Right. It's like they'd really studied all of the races and decided, okay, this is how we're going to maneuver this to set them upon each other so that we have as little work to do as possible.
Although, interestingly enough, Klingon stuff was not originally planned.
Really?
No, at least according to what I've read, and I mean, I wasn't in the room, so I can't tell you for sure, but according to what I've
been... I'm disappointed, Oren.
Yeah. According to what I've been reading, the Klingon stuff was added when they decided to bring Worf on. Like, that makes sense. That was not in the... Like, the Dominion War wasn't going to kick off for another season, and they were going to do... Like, they kind of had another season of, like, just sort of stuff, right, planned, and, like, they were told they needed to do something to spice it up, so they were like, okay, well, we'll bring Worf on board, and we can have this conflict with the Klingons, and it really slotted in very nicely, because the Cardassians had been kind of trailing off as the potential for villains, because they'd just been beaten too many times by that point. So then we bring in the Klingons, who were like... And that made it all... way more complicated, because the Klingons had been our allies, but, like, even in Next Generation, there was clearly some tension there, right?
Yeah.
And that showed that the Star Trek universe could, like, change, and it wasn't static. Like, they could be our allies, and they could not be our allies because our interests no longer coincide, and it just goes on and on.
Yeah,
and
I would not have known. It really felt like it was completely pawned out.
And, I mean, I think that was one of the strengths of the showrunner at Deep Space Nine, was that he was very good at, like, rolling with the punches and, like, doing new stuff when he lost certain things and what have you. I was going to say that the other one I have on my list is the Borg, who are probably, like, they're not a standard military empire, but they are very interesting, at least when they're first introduced, right?
Right. Then they had the Queen, and that goes downhill a little bit.
Yeah.
But...
Which is another example of, like, when you learn more about the bad guys, they become less interesting, right? Because when they were first introduced, it was a very fascinating concept that was certainly not original to Star Trek, but certainly popularized by Star Trek, of the collective consciousness. The idea of harvesting resources rather than, like, trying to conquer territory. Because originally, the whole assimilation thing didn't start until later. When the Borg first showed up, they were not interested in assimilating you. They just wanted to harvest your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the assimilation of Picard into Locutus was actually very unusual. Which made sense. A friend of mine pointed out that, like, you couldn't really have a collective if everyone in it didn't want to be there. Because they explain that the collective consciousness is supposed to be every single person in the collective all wired together, all making decisions at once. And how would that work if everyone is brought into it by force, right? That doesn't work. The idea of bringing Picard into it was weird and, like, not something the Borg had done before.
Although I can explain the how people being unwilling brought into it would work. I mean, one thing that I would like to see more in stories that have an antagonist organization that, you know, you have to, first of all, you have to come up a reason why your antagonist organization is evil. And one that I don't see very much, probably because it requires a little bit more depth, is just having an organization where the culture has just become toxic.
Mm-hmm.
Because that does happen to actual organizations where they will just become a culture of either they, you know, one-upsmanship that requires illegal activity or being sabotage of various kinds where the culture just encourages really bad things. And the problem is, like, yeah, you can catch some of them and fire them, but as soon as they hire new people, those people are initiated into the same culture and end up doing the same bad things. And it's a real phenomenon that's I find very interesting that can explain a lot of bad behaviors that are specific to organizations that, regardless of the people in them. I guess with the Borg, I can imagine if you have a collective bringing somebody new on, that person is unwilling at first, but then becomes kind of indoctrinated.
I don't know. I have a hard time with that. what you're describing is a case of someone gets hired, which means they joined willingly and then they get converted. Weird. It means they wanted to be there. It would be a lot harder to be corrupted by the values of an organization you didn't want to be part of in the first place.
Yeah, I guess it's more like Stockholm Syndrome or something.
With the Borg, the way they ended up characterizing them, it's more they bring someone new in, and that person is an extra hard drive, and their personality and is all of the data on the hard drive, and it's wiped clean, rather than hard drive, I guess RAM would be better.
Mm-hmm.
So it adds to the collective processing power, but they've eliminated the individual.
They've added another node to the cluster, basically, which is not what they first established them.
Right.
They changed that later, I think partly because TNG had actually started humanizing the Borg and had started going with the idea that the Borg could be a species we might potentially be able to live in harmony with, like live in peace with them. Towards the end of TNG, they had that idea. And then, like, later, when they were searching for bad guys for Star Trek for the film, they were like, we could probably just use the Borg. Everyone knows how scary they are. And no one remembers the later episodes with Borg in them. So we'll go with that. And then the Borg became the big bad guys again. And then, like, Voyager was like, let's steal TNG's villains. And then they did that. So at that point, the idea of the Borg being something that you could reason with went out the door.
The whole queen decision, like, I kind of get why they made that decision, because in most cases, yeah, you do want a figurehead for your antagonist organization that people can talk to and work with. That's the kind of an icon. But the Borg were distinctive because they didn't have that. And that because they've seemed very alien. And just putting in a sexy queen just really took away from that.
Well, and particularly, the Borg's biggest issue was that they were introduced as the unbeatable villains. That was their thing.
Yeah,
and
because Picard had to actually beg Q, which is an omnipotent character, to save them.
Right.
That was the whole idea of when they met them, that was something they could not defeat.
And so that was why I think the later TNG episodes that include the Borg, they're not actually fighting the Borg anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they have two more episodes that have the Borg in them. One of them is I-Borg, which is the episode where they separate a drone from the collective and his, like, individuality starts to come back. And then the other one is, the next episode after that is Descent, where they meet that Borg again. And they actually kind of imply that the collective's been destroyed in that episode. They don't say it outright, but they sort of imply it. I think partially because the TNG writers realize that you can't beat the unbeatable villains more than once. Then they lose their teeth at that point. But, you know, the Voyager writers were apparently didn't have that kind of qualm. And hey, how many times can you beat the unbeatable villain? It turns out a lot.
that was too bad. Also in the category of, like, what the organization's doing really achieve the ends that they're going for, I've seen some very good points about Hunger Games. The capital flaunting their wealth is not how you keep a country in order. Constantly rubbing into everybody how you have so much money and you have enough food to eat when nobody else does is not a way to stop rebellion from happening. And also, like, you know, later when they're being invaded and they spend all their times, like, setting elaborate traps instead of actually just, like, fighting invaders. I know that technology's high, but I can't help but feel that some of those traps really take a long time to set up.
My favorite one of those was when President of the Capitol, if he had just destroyed the raid that they launched to try to rescue PETA, he would have taken out the highest-ranking military officer in District 13, because for some reason he was leading the mission personally. But instead, he let it happen so that he could ruin Katniss's day, basically, was his thing. Because, like, there's no way he thought that PETA trying to kill Katniss was actually going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so that was clearly just a psychological tactic. And it just seemed, like, not a worth it trade. It was just, you know.
Let's make the girl who's already angry at us even angrier. That's going to definitely help our cause.
Maybe hoping that she would no longer function as a propaganda tool. I don't know. It's also like societies are very protective of their children. So that's another thing, right? The whole concept that you can get people to do what you say by killing their kids is generally what you do is you try to make them think that they like can't rebel because if they do, their kids will die. But in the Hunger Games, it's like, we've killed your kids, now don't rebel. And it's like the opposite of how that normally works.
Like, they could maybe have gotten away with it in the year immediately following the rebellion when people are feeling at the lowest point after being utterly crushed. But it's what, 50 years? 75 years.
But the explanation for why they do it is that it's supposed to prevent rebellion.
Yeah.
By, like, reminding the districts of how they control them or something. But it would have the opposite effect.
Right. Like, again, it might work in the first year or two after overwhelming military defeat. But beyond that, it's just going to remind everyone why they hate them so much.
Right. Like, the way that you maintain an oppressive government is by making people think they still have something left to lose. And in the case of Hunger Games, they've made it very clear you have nothing to lose, especially the poorer districts. Like, the ones that are a little nicer, like the ones that make the jewelry and stuff, like, those it makes sense. Because those guys, they get to look at the poor districts and are like, well, we're better off than them at least. But for the poor districts, it's like, they have nothing. There is nothing left for them to lose, and yet they don't rise. And we've seen what happened in real life. What happens in real life when you push people that hard, right, is that they form ISIS. Like, yeah. That's what happens when you do that.
I feel like the very least, if you don't want to rebel, you should just make sure that everybody has enough to eat. Because, like, people are pretty unhappy when they are starving.
Yeah, the number of rebellions and revolts that have toppled dynasties that start with bread or rice in the name throughout history is staggering. And additionally, you do not give them distinct identities. You don't reinforce the tribalism by pitting the different districts against each other. You want them to feel all as part of the nation, just at the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, like, you can do the whole, like, pitting them against someone else. I mean, that did work very well for a certain fellow named Hitler. But you do that by, like, taking a very small part of your population and saying, those guys, you have to fight them. They're the enemy. Everyone else is us.
Yes.
Right?
Or making up an outside nation. Suppose this is what North Korea does for the U.S. It's yes. Like, U.S. is really, really bad. We need to unite against them.
Oh, yeah. A foreign enemy always works.
I was actually reading a young adult novel, like, a couple weeks ago, and they had that, like, where, like, that 1984 thing, where it's like, you must give your life to fight the evil enemy, like, and I was so used to this trope that I was just waiting for the reveal that there was no evil enemy, and then, like, we got into one of the later books, and then we met the evil enemy, and they were actually jerks, and and it was like, it didn't make the government good, but right. That part of their propaganda was actually true.
Crazy twist. And I was they've like, not been lying to you the whole time.
Yes, it was the anti-twist, right? It was like only a twist to me, the reader, because I expected it to go the other way.
Right.
Which was
kind
actually
of a subversion,
yeah, it was quite brilliant.
Yeah, I'm all about hard character decisions, right? It's like when you get in that situation, like, my government is evil, but the enemy is also evil. That's a good place to be.
We've been talking a lot about revolutions and such. Another evil organization that's on my bad list is the Red Lotus Society from the third season of Korra.
You mean those four guys?
Yeah, those four guys.
Four dudes.
This was really baffling to me, okay? Because they bring up the Red Lotus Society, which they talk about like it's a big conspiracy, and then they immediately drop it. And it's like, why didn't you just have it be those four guys? Or five guys, maybe it was. How many guys were there?
Five guys, burger and fries.
There were, like, a few of them. And, like, part of the problem is that season four...
I want a burger.
Yeah, me too, actually. Part of the problem is that season four is so rushed that the villains don't get any backstory. Just, it was weird when they were so rushed for time that they decided to introduce a really big organization that supposedly had other members who we'd not met yet. And then, like, granted, I'm glad they didn't follow up on that because season four of Korra is brilliant and what they do there is fantastic. But season three is part of the reason season three feels like it's not as good as it could have been is that they introduced these supposedly big sprawling villains and then, like, did nothing with them.
In retrospect, I think it's supposed to be that the Red Lotus was defeated and these are the most powerful of the Red Lotus that they keep locked up.
Right.
But they never made that clear. So yeah, I was also expecting more of an organization to kind of rally behind them after they were freed, and that never came to fruition.
Yeah, the impression that I got is that they were once big and then, like, everybody else kind of quit and they were the last left, but that doesn't make them sound very good.
They also had some serious, like, theme confusion where part of their theme was that they were anarchists. Like, they wanted to end government. And then the other part of their theme was that they wanted to kill the Avatar. And, like, those two things are not really connected. Like, because the Avatar is not a government. The Avatar doesn't govern anything.
Their complaint was specifically with Aang and how he did start to form a government. And so they felt that the Avatar had therefore betrayed its purpose, and that's why they wanted to end the cycle.
Yeah, and that's not, like, incompatible, but, like, Korra wasn't doing that. It seemed like their goals, the part where the Red Lotus Society is at their best is when they're overthrowing the Earth Kingdom.
Yes.
Like, that is the best part of season three, and that part actually works very well, but partly because we never saw any of that stuff that Aang did, right? If you read the comics, you see some of it. Those comics are good. I recommend them.
But, so good.
But if you didn't do your summer reading, you never saw any of that. And so it was not clear to me how they thought killing Korra was going to accomplish their goal of ending governments.
They saw the Avatar as an authority figure, especially after what Aang did. And they also saw Aang's use of the White Lotus to form a larger organization around the Avatar as a corruption of the Lotus philosophy. So it wasn't just to kill Korra. Like, they didn't have any qualms with Korra herself. It was they wanted to end the Avatar cycle permanently because the Avatar could potentially be the ultimate in tyrannical authority over
them. Right, and it's not that that is an impossible idea for villains. It's just that because each season of Korra is so short, the fact that they decided to introduce these villains who are supposedly a big sprawling conspiracy and have two goals that are not immediately obviously connected, they had to do a lot of work to try to connect those, and because season three is so short, they didn't really have a lot of time.
Right.
Yeah, they could have definitely used more time.
And the big sprawling conspiracy was 15 years and prior to the show, so it's like they just briefly talk about how menacing they once were as an organization, and then completely switch gears to these four people that are incredibly powerful.
Yeah, and it's a little bit like, oh, by the way, don't you remember when they kidnapped you before? And it's like, it feels a little retroactive.
When you
there.
Were two?
Mm-hmm. Like, doing it right, in season four, they introduce the Earth Kingdom is the villain, right? Like, the villain organization is Kuvira's army, which takes over the Earth Kingdom and basically becomes the Earth Kingdom. And her goal from day one is...
I believe industrialization is the villain, Orin.
And her goal from day one is unite the Earth Kingdom. When I was first watching the first couple episodes, before it had become clear what was happening, I was like, hey, isn't Republic City built on Earth Kingdom territory?
Yeah.
How is that going to work? Is Kuvira really going to be cool with that? And I was like, no. And that was perfect. That was beautiful. It was this, it all came together in this amazing way because their goal fit beautifully with having to destroy or at least hurt the thing that the heroes cared about the most, right?
Yeah, it was also really nice after Avatar The Last Airbender because the thing about the Fire Nation, it was really good, but we still have this sort of stereotypical association with like, oh, fire is bad.
Fire
bad. So the people who wield fire are, of course, the bad guys, which, you know what? It was fine. It worked fine for Avatar The Last Airbender, but it was really nice to see that sort of turn around and a different kingdom that had been sort of the good kingdom before, like, fall into the hands of the tyrant. That was nice to get that turned around.
The last season of Korra also did a perfect job of escalation, which you talked about earlier, Chris, in how she kept upping the level of her threat with larger and more organized armies and larger and more powerful war machines throughout the season.
So as Korra, like, slowly recovered, you know, it worked really well, because Korra's weakness in the beginning also helped keep the escalation level down in the beginning.
Right, because in season four, they finally got a handle on the Avatar state that had been, like, plaguing them since season one. Because in season one, they were just like, she can't do it. Just can't do it. Okay, fine. Season two, she can do it, and, like, now it has to be really weak because she uses it constantly. Season three, she's just forgotten that she can do it. In season four, it's like, okay, she can't do it because she has this terrible trauma associated with it, and every time she tries, bad things happen. Like, okay, great.
Right.
You've got that
figured
out. She's
going through recovery.
Right, and again, like, any character arc would expect, like, a recovery to happen. It's only in one season, so that's just fine. Like, if they'd done a season five, there might have been, like, oh, shoot, what do we do now? But, like, for one, they ended it, so that was totally cool.
They could have taken the Gurren Lagann approach and just continued escalating unto infinity.
I think the third Matrix movie that never happened showed us what was wrong with that.
There is no third Matrix movie. I haven't even seen it. I saw the second one and I said I had no desire to see anything more to do with the Matrix ever again.
There's this long fight sequence where Agent Smith, like, there's a million Agent Smiths, and he all fights them all at once, and it's all CG, and you can tell it's CG, and it's just the most ridiculous.
I've seen gifs of that.
Yeah, I would say that's not true Gurren Lagann style of infinite escalation, because they just add more, but the threat doesn't get larger, it just gets more numerous. Whereas in Korra, it gets larger. They just need to keep doing that.
Just forever until they're galaxy bending at each other. I've got the theme.
Earth bending becomes literal.
I've got the premise for the next Avatar series.
Fire bending involves entire stars.
Ooh, fusion bending. So, I think we're about out of time. I actually had another one on the list that we didn't have time to get to, so that's fine.
Well, now you have to say it, Orin, because
you did it. Okay, so the other one is Caesar's Legion from Fallout New Vegas, which is terrible in, like, every possible way, because they're both the worst jerks. They're not sympathetic at all. They're slavers and rapists and murderers.
Oh, geez.
And they're super misogynistic. And if you're playing a female character, they don't even, like, pretend they're going to make an exception for you once they've won. So they're just the worst in every possible way. And they're not threatening at all because they run around with gladiuses and their enemies have assault rifles.
What's a gladius?
The gladius is a Roman short sword.
Oh.
Because they're stabbing.
Because they're all Roman themed, sort of. They look like they got a bunch of, like, discount Roman
costumes. Oh, and their enemies have assault rifles.
Yes, their enemies have assault rifles.
So why hasn't somebody, like, murdered them already?
That's really the question that you are asking yourself.
Yeah, they come from Caesar's Palace Casino in Vegas.
We wish. That's not the actual plot.
What?
It seems like it would be, but it's not. They actually come from Utah, apparently.
What?
Yeah, I know.
Did they at least pick their theme once they were in Vegas, or did they pick it in Utah?
I'd like to think that they knew they were coming to Vegas, and that's why they went.
Well, Orin did say bad in every way imaginable, so...
Yeah, another reason why I will not play Fallout New Vegas.
But they are also, like, the worst part of... So they're not sympathetic at all. Like, not even a little bit. But also, they're not that scary, because the plot of New Vegas is that the NCR has already defeated them once, and now they're, like, gearing up for round two, and you're supposed...
They gotta sharpen those gladiuses.
Yeah.
Get out your whetstones, everybody.
And it's... But it seems like if you as the main character do nothing, the NCR will just beat them again. Like, it seems inconceivable that Caesar's Legion could possibly win this fight, which is why when you actually get to the fight, it's comedic, because the Caesar's Legion end guys are incredibly powerful, because they just have endless pools of health. So you watch them, like, run towards the NCR guys with their hammers, and the NCR guys are just unloading on them, like, hundreds and hundreds of rounds, and because it's a video game, they are, like, their health slowly ticks down, and then they just murder the NCR guys.
Oh my god.
Wow.
But, you know, weird video game physics aside, they don't seem threatening at all.
Yeah. That is one kind of law of antagonists in general. Threatening or sympathetic. Choose one.
Yeah.
If you can have both, that's great, but you need at least one.
Or you can go the Caesar's Legion and choose neither.
Yeah. And I do feel like I should point out, I actually like Fallout New Vegas. There's good stuff in it. It's just the Legion is the weakest part. But there's other good stuff. I would actually recommend it. But anyway, we're out of time now. We need to go. if anything that we said made you mad, you can email us at podcast@mythcreants.com. Otherwise, we'll see you in a few weeks. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess who saved herself.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.